We're in the auditorium of the Salk Institute in La Jolla, California, where later today, today's guest, Horace Barlow of the University of Cambridge, will deliver the Francis Crick Nobel Lecture. This is one of the Institute's ongoing series of Nobel Lectures, and Francis Crick, of course, was co-discoverer with Jim Watson of the secret of life, the double helix structure of the DNA molecule, in 1953, and although most of Crick's earlier career was spent at the University of Cambridge, he was a professor here at Salk from 1976 until his death in 2004. So there are two immediate obvious connections between Francis Crick and this year's Crick lecturer. First of all, Cambridge, where Horace Barlow spent most of his professional life working in visual neuroscience, physiology, perception. And you were, in fact, as I recall, Royal Society Professor of Research in Physiology for the University of Cambridge, and you're now at Trinity. And secondly, those subjects that we've just been talking about were the kind of primary entree to the study of consciousness, which Francis Crick was largely responsible for making a respectable scientific enterprise. What consciousness is for, the making of minds, those are also subjects I know that greatly interest you. But first, let's do Cambridge and Crick. Do you recall meeting Francis? Was this pre-DNA, or was it on his radar at this point? Do you recall the circumstances?
Yes, I recall very well. I'll tell you the story. I got a call from Francis Crick. Well, not from Francis Crick. I think it was from a friend of his, saying, would I like to meet Francis Crick, who wanted to talk about neuroscience. I think in 1951, as far as I can date it. And we met and we talked, and I told him what I was doing. But then he was a physicist who had taken up biology and had already done one thesis project. And he was casting around for a more interesting area to work in. And he was wondering about neuroscience. So we chatted at a cafe in Cambridge for, I suppose, an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, and I talked about what I was doing for half an hour or so, and he asked, as he always did, a whole lot of surprisingly penetrating questions, considering that he ostensibly knew nothing about neuroscience, you know, but he obviously had been reading about it. And then I said, but what else are you considering doing? And then for the next good hour, I think, he talked about the possibilities that he saw arising from analysis of the structure of DNA. This is in 1951, a couple of years before it was they got anywhere, or got the solution rather, and actually before he'd started working with Jim Watson. And I was absolutely bowled over, and I was amazed at what he saw as the possibilities. And I told him at the end, look, that if just 1% of what you're talking about comes off, it's going to be 10 times as important as anything I can see happening in neuroscience for the next N years, you know. And he said, well, what about consciousness? And so I said, well, you're not going to get far with consciousness until you know about the origin of life. Do that first, you know? Which, of course, is what he did.
So this is very interesting. So these subjects were there from way at the beginning, because he also did some stuff with Sidney Brenner on the notion of the origins of life, possibly panspermia and so on and so forth, with Leslie Orgel, sorry.
Yes.
The idea that Francis was already thinking about this whole notion of consciousness and indeed of DNA in such depth is quite surprising in a sense.
Yes, it is. But of course, he's largely responsible for where we are in molecular biology, and his vision of what might transpire from finding out more about this molecule is absolutely amazing. I never cease to wonder about it. He told me last time I saw him, he said that he himself, whenever he thought about those early years in the early 50s and so on, he was astounded at how rapidly it all developed and how it followed quite closely what more or less what he was expecting. It wasn't not exactly, of course. There were things where he got it wrong in his imagination, but he had amazing ability to see what the possibilities were, just by just from discovering the structure of DNA.
Well, just before we shift on to just one last thing on Francis, this is the quick lecture. What were some of the things that he was setting out to you in that conversation as possible futures?
Well, one thing I remember we talked about quite a lot was the Chargaff's discovery of the non-random variation of the different bases in DNA from different sources, and because he immediately connected that with the possibility of DNA pairs being the coding elements and so on. But my memory is not up to remembering exactly what he suggested then, and I must have got some of it wrong, because I can remember he talked about solving the actual coding problem, which of course wasn't solved until very much later. So I must have added that onto my remembered story of meeting him in that cafe and talking about these things. And ever since then, of course, I've seen him quite frequently and regularly. I never got anywhere in explaining my own ideas about consciousness to him, by the way. He was very resistant to them.
What was he resistant to? What were your ideas?
Well, it's always seemed to me that humans are social animals, and that without being able to have the kind of conversation we're having now, where I explain my ideas to you and you reciprocate, it's so basic that we expect to be able to ask each other, why did you do this? Why are you holding your glasses in your hand now? Why are you doing this? And you give me an answer. And that's sort of part of such a natural part of our life that we don't stop to think of what an extraordinarily complex mechanism is required for my brain to be able to explain to your brain what's going on inside it. And that is consciousness, what consciousness does. It enables, it makes a medium of communication between us.
So the biological function of consciousness would be?
Well, to oil the wheels of social life, so to speak, make it possible. Without me being able to explain to you what I've done, reasons for what I've done, and you being able to explain to me what's going on in your mind, we couldn't have the kind of social life we do. Nor could we have the field of external knowledge that we have, a store of knowledge that's in libraries and universities. Nor, for that matter, would we have the means of communicating with each other, which are behind building up the material side of social structure, and art, and buildings, and so on.
Now, are you saying that, are you limiting consciousness to humans?
Not necessarily. I don't. It's quite clear that animals do communicate with each other, and sometimes very effectively, as when dogs manage to herd a group of sheep in cooperation. They know what each other's doing and what they're going to do, and so on. So they must have some consciousness, and a dog and its master obviously have some communication with each other, which is. If we give ourselves consciousness, we've got to give the dogs consciousness too, to some extent. But the importance of this component in the activity of our brains must be so much greater than it is in any other animal that I think one's.
I'm thinking now that the title of Francis's book on consciousness was The Astonishing Hypothesis. Yeah. I think the subtitle was Science and the Search for the Soul, or The Scientific Search for the Soul.
Yes.
And yet, somewhere in the book, which is would be called extremely reductionistic,
yes,
I suppose, he basically says that you, your feelings, your desires, and so on and so forth, you're nothing but a pack of neurons. Do you agree with that?
Is this, are you asking me for a value judgment, or I think it's true, but I don't think it's a very good summary of the brain to say that it's a pack of neurons.
Okay, well, where I was going to go with this is, and we will elaborate this, is into your own work, and the notion of the neuron doctrine, the idea that neurons in fact do, that we would now say that there's neural correlates of yeah. certain things. I would like to have a discussion with you, since this is a great deal of work that you've done over 50 years of study of vision and perception, about where knowledge resides and how we store it. And my specific reason is that the cover of Discover magazine for June 2009, in other words, next month's yeah. cover, has on it a storyline here that says, "Can a single neuron recognize Jennifer Aniston?" So in other words, in here, Carl Zimmer, the science writer, has written a couple of pages discussing something we will elaborate on, grandmother cells, yeah. the possibility of grandmother cells, the possibility of there being cells specified to recognize only individuals like Jennifer Aniston in this particular case, and in certain situations. And this is based on a long review paper that just came out in the Psychological Review. Now, how knowledge is stored, whether it's localized in individual neurons, or as most constructivist people would think in terms of parallel processing and so on, are very different views. And perhaps these are being put at extremes here on a spectrum. But I was surprised to see this, because this was a story that I thought was over and done a long time ago, and the verdict was in terms of parallel processing of networks and so on, that the idea of a neuron actually is being smart enough to know whether you're looking at Halle Berry or Jennifer Aniston couldn't possibly be the case. Now this takes us straight back to your early work, your career work on discussing where knowledge is stored and the whole concept of grandmother cells. I wonder if you could elaborate on that and bring it up, to give me the history and the context.
Yes. Well, historically, the ability to record from single neurons in the periphery, that only became possible with the use of valve amplifiers and things like that in, roughly speaking, the post-First World War years. When people started using amplifiers to pick up action potentials, and they could record the action potentials of single nerve fibers in the periphery. That was the work of the school, largely originating from E.D. Adrian in Cambridge. But of course it spread, and people solved or investigated all the senses, I think with the exception of olfaction, and were able to record sensory impulses from these single fibers. Then at about the time of the First World War, people started being able to record from single ganglion cells in the retina. Now, the retina is an outgrowth from the brain, is really part of the brain. So this, at this point, one was able to record the action potentials of single nerve fibers inside the brain. And this work was carried out in many countries, many places, many parts of the brain, but it was interrupted by the Second World War, and it was really only after the Second World War that people could do it. And the earliest that people could record from neurons in the cerebral cortex was about 1950 or 60, so it's quite a slow development.
But there was a group, there was a group then also working at MIT as well, Jerry Letkin,
yes.
Who wrote a classic paper, What the Frog's Eye Tells
yes,
the Frog's
indeed.
Brain.
Yes.
Right? But you were also working on frog retina.
Yes. Well, I was working quite a long time before that, actually, in 1949, 53. And the main gist of that work on single neurons was to show there were much more powerful and reliable elements that had previously been supposed. Working with some colleagues, I discovered that you could record from the ganglion cells in the cat retina, for example, and show that they responded to the absorption of single quanta of light. One quantum of light caused not just one impulses, but in many cases, a whole cluster of impulses. So that by recording from one nerve fiber, you could detect when a threshold stimulus arrived for the cat. And this was a great surprise to a lot of people who'd always supposed that the well-known high sensitivity of the eye, for example, resulted from the fact that it was interpreting a message along a very large number of nerve fibers. I mean, in the case of the human eye, it's about 1 million nerve fibers. But it turns out that the element of sensitivity, so to speak, a single impulse, was of the same order of magnitude as the minimum amount that you could detect. And many, many other examples of this in touch and in other fields showed that the single neurons in the brain were significant elements, and you didn't have to have millions and millions of them in parallel to get any sensations. Well, that was all right up to a point, and it was a surprise to find elements which are quite selective in their responses, and particularly, for example, in the cortex itself, you had units that you could it was very difficult to excite at all until you'd found what we call the trigger feature, the element in the sensory stimulus that actually causes it to respond. That was Hubel and Wiesel's discovery, to find out that this was depending critically on the orientation of that stimulus. And until you got an oriented stimulus, you couldn't get these cells to respond. Very frustrating, because you've gone through the process of quite an elaborate process of putting an electrode and recording from a single neuron, and you know you've got that because every now and then it gives a spontaneous action potential, which you recognize as an action potential. You know you're recording from a neuron, but nothing you can do, waving your hands, flashing lights on the whole eye, it pays no attention. And then in their case, David Hubel gave a very vivid description of how they discovered accidentally, they did all sorts of sensible things to increase their chances of getting a response. But then quite accidentally, they had little images on a slide, and they pushed the slide into their projector. And by chance, the edge of the slide was of the correct orientation to stimulate the cell they were recording from. And whereas what they wanted to stimulate it with was a little spot of light. But they couldn't get, by moving the spot everywhere, they couldn't get any responses. And accidentally, they stimulated with the edge. And of course, they then very rapidly found that if the edge was wrong, or they knew that, let's say, the receptive field projected out to this region here, and that by accident they got it the right orientation, and they said, well, that's when it responds, you know, when this rather faint shadow mm-hmm. of the right orientation created by the edge, glass edge of the slide fell on the receptive field. And they were able to show that also it had to be the right orientation. And from that point on, of course, it's easy going. And, 20 years of easy going.
Well, again, one of the great serendipity stories, of course. Yes. But how do we move from there to this whole notion of how knowledge is stored? And why am I back with the cover of Discover magazine having apparently a debate that I thought was over? So the whole notion of the grandmother cell was something that Letvin used in a kind of pejorative sense, right? Because he didn't believe that at all. It was originally Sherrington who talked about all this ecclesiastical difficult language. He talked about pontifical cells, right?
Well, I think J. Letvin did believe in them. He wrote this. He wrote me a letter. People often accuse me of having invented the grandmother cell, and I didn't. So I knew that, of course. I searched around who to find who did, and John Mullen, a colleague, suggested to me that I should write to Jerry Letvin and find out, and I did, and he wrote me back a long letter, which was an admirable sample of Jerry Letvin's mode of thinking, because it was a long story about a Soviet neurophysiologist who believed that there were such things as mother cells, and so on and so forth. And then he got into political trouble, so he had to change it to grandmother. But anyway, so, but he got things right that the because he pointed out that it's not just the selectivity of these neurons which is remarkable, it's the fact that they respond to the same selective feature in spite of changing the circumstances of a very big range. I mean, you change the angle at which you're looking at grandmother or Jennifer Aniston or whatever it may be, and it still responds the same, and even the written name excites it. So here you're having something at a much higher level than just the physical stimulus, which is still selective for the features which enables it to respond to the person, grandmother, whatever it may be. And it also has a full range of invariances, enables it to go on responding, in spite of your changing the point of view, the clothing, everything, except the essence of grandmother.
Well, but where is the notion of grandmother, say, or Jennifer Aniston contained? Is that not contained in networks of representation? Do we have this?
You don't have grandmother cells in the retina. They're far centrally, so that cell is connected through a network to the retina. So there's a network there, all right. But the final representation is not necessarily in just one example of grandmother cell, because if that was the case, you wouldn't really have any chance of, for example, in the case of Christoph Koch and his colleagues, when they were finding these remarkable cells in humans awaiting operations, you wouldn't happen to have a photograph of Jennifer Aniston and have a chance of hitting a Jennifer Aniston neuron. Either there are a large number or there must be something there that we don't yet understand.
Yes, because these were patients who were having depth electrodes implanted.
Yes.
In an effort to cure some intractable epilepsy.
Yes.
Right. And so they were able to explore, as it were, the neural terrain.
Yes.
To find out which bits appeared to be the neural correlates of outside percept.
Yes, that was the. But that their recording was such that they could only record from something like, I don't know what the number was, but 10 neurons at a time at the most. And if there are 10 to the 10 neurons in the brain, and you're recording from 10 of them, and just one of the neurons in the brain responds to, you're not going to be able to find it, you know. So there must be a mystery there which we don't yet understand.
Okay. To make a slight leap, though, one of the other issues that comes up in when we're talking about the brain is and the organization of knowledge, is whether we construct representational networks, or whether we have inherited to some extent modules, or whether there's some territory in between. How much of the brain is modular, in a sense? And some people do argue that there do seem to be some areas that are dedicated to face recognition, for example.
Yes, yes.
But the question again becomes, are those areas which become face dedicated areas, do they result during development, or are they there, as it were, in the genome, reliably developing?
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yes. The other person who was responsible for thoughts along these lines was Konorski, a Polish, a student of Pavlov's, actually, who's best known for his work on conditioned reflexes. But he was also a clinician, very interested in aphasias, well, the people's disability to speak, to recognize and, words and to speak and to use these things. And he became aware, as I think many other clinicians did, that there were often very highly specific aphasias that people could not recognize and talk about animals, for example, or moving small man-made objects. These are two categories I happen to remember. But if you see a very large number of these patients, you come to recognize that these specific agnosias are quite common, and often for the same classes of object in different people. And that must surely be determined by some genetic predisposition for there to be such classes, which by no means excludes the possibility that they also learn a lot about that. It's also an acquired characteristic that depends upon the diet of things that the person has spoken about and of the words that we have to recognize these things.
Konorski, in fact, called them Gnostic cells.
That's correct, yes. Well, he called them, first of all, Gnostic regions, and within them, as soon as he heard about Hubel and Wiesel results, he talked about Gnostic neurons and the idea of these being formed by a category of, by a hierarchy of operations.
The reason I pursued this particular line is that one is struck by the, especially as consciousness becomes a subject that's more respectable and so on, and as we develop technologies like functional magnetic resonance imaging, there is a burgeoning industry now in finding neural correlates for behaviors like, you know, empathy and so on and so forth. And there have also been some recent papers published which have criticized what appears to some people at least to be a kind of neo-phrenology, where the statistical methods are not strong enough to support the claims that are being made for the use of the magnet. Is this, do you think, just one of those things as we go ahead in progress that the results will get better, or is there a genuine sense that the technology is being asked to deliver and carry too much freight in terms of understanding what we can about the human brain and the mind?
Well, it's a wonderful technique, the fMRI imaging, but a lot of the early work was in fact not repeatable, but it didn't stop it getting a lot of publicity. So I'm always skeptical when I hear about these results, but most of them have, I think, been verified. But there are certain technical things here which worry me very much. It's the main one is that it depends upon detecting changes of blood flow. But if you measure changes of blood flow accurately in the periphery, you find that the blood flow through a muscle, for example, depends very much not just on whether it's being exercised, but on whether you expect it to be exercised. So if you have a person with two arms in this crude method of measuring blood flow in the muscles, and they may be asked to exercise the left hand or the right hand, and if you devise a situation so that you expect them, the person is expecting it to occur in the left arm, then that's where the blood flow starts increasing first, and you get a massive increase in the blood flow in the muscles of that arm, even before it starts working. So this same effect presumably must occur in the control of blood flow in the brain. It's always interpreted as being a direct response to the activity in that particular region, but that's a very insecure assumption. It could well be that the rest of the brain says, we know that something is going to happen, is going to cause activity in that region, we better put some more blood there. So that it's the expectation of activity, not the activity itself, that's causing the change. And this kind of thing is not adequately controlled, and except in very, very few studies. And in many of those studies, it shows just what I was saying, that there's evidence that the blood flow response is due to expectation, not what actually happens.
But your sense, if you're explaining to, if you have grandchildren or something,
yes,
what makes them tick?
Yes.
and why they think the way they possibly do, and so on. Do you stress the neuron doctrine in the sense that you, or the extreme statement of it, which is you're nothing but a pack of neurons?
Yeah, no, I'm stressed to them strongly that the brain is more than just a bunch of neurons. That it's a very, first of all, it's a very highly organized bunch of neurons. They're not just randomly connected with each other. There's an enormous amount of structure there. I mean, just look at Cajal's pictures, more than 100 years old, showing incredible complexity and regularity of connections in these things. That can't be arisen. That can't be there just for nothing. All that organized structure must be doing something. So I think the idea that it's a disorganized mass that somehow magically manages to organize itself won't get you very far.
You mentioned, we were talked about family there. I know that you are, although this is the year of Darwin, but Darwin's bicentennial, and you've been roped into a great deal of stuff about this, and you're a bit Darwined out, but yeah. I think we should at least mention the fact that you are one of Darwin's great-grandchildren.
That's right, yes.
And this is worth dwelling on, because if one looks at the family tree and so on, it's an extraordinary, distinguished, and widespread family, starting with the Darwins and the Wedgwoods. You would be the sixth generation, if you count.
Going back to Josiah.
Josiah Wedgwood and Erasmus Darwin, who were obviously, they were living in the late 18th century.
Yes.
And were members of a group called the Lunar Society of Birmingham, which is a group of businessmen and scientists who got together to meet on a regular basis. It included Matthew Boulton and Priestley and so on. Mm. So there was this great community that built up. And the Darwins and the Wedgwoods, there's also intermarriages with the Huxleys at some point. Your own father was Sir Alan Barlow.
Yes.
And your mother was Nora?
Nora Darwin.
Nora Darwin, who became Nora Barlow. Yes. She in fact, edited or re-edited the autobiography of Charles Darwin, right?
Yes. She was one of the earliest people to put Charles Darwin really on a pedestal and say, look, what he did was remarkable and has had remarkable effects. She was also a geneticist herself. She didn't ever have a university education.
Right.
She worked with William Bateson, who was a geneticist, and has her name actually on some quite important papers, I believe. But she took it upon herself to try and collect together as many Darwiniana as she could. And she eventually succeeded in persuading the university library to act as a repository of this. So she's in some sense the founder of the Darwin industry, because the university library now has hordes of people coming and looking at this material every year, you know.
And she lived to 104, as I recall.
That's right. Yes.
She had a long time putting the business together.
Yes. So I've sort of been hearing about Darwin all my life.
Yeah.
And she was a good botanist and a good natural historian. She's recognized birds quicker than anybody else and so on. And so she taught me a lot of, and she also was very encouraging, you know, about encouraging one's powers of observation and asking, I wonder what that means, and so on and so forth. So she was very, she did that on top of having six children and running an enormous house with many frequent visitors. So
did you always have the sense that you would be some sort of a scientist? When you were growing up, was this... Because
yes.
A huge number of them are, there's the Galtons as well, who
yes.
are intermarried and so on. Yes. So there's an awful lot of people in the extended family and the intermarried family who are extremely well-known scientists in their own right.
Yes, yes. Yeah, well, I always wanted to be a scientist because it seemed to me that, I suppose, just as a doctor's children tend to regard doctors as being the highest form of creation, we were brought up to believe, at least my mother's side encouraged the belief that being a scientist was the highest form of life. My father's side wasn't quite like that. My grandfather was a very successful Victorian physician, and so I actually did medicine too as well. That's partly because it didn't seem to be there was a great demand for doctors at the beginning of the Second World War, and that seemed to be a good thing to do. But I found I preferred the scientific aspects of medicine to the actual clinical aspects. So I went into that. That's when I came back to Cambridge and worked with E.D. Adrian as his student.
Yeah, if one goes to, if you go to Google and put in neurotree and then somebody's name, you can find this sort of genealogical tables, as you know, of scientists in neuroscience in this particular instance, and who their fathers were, who their children are. And you are situated in the midst of a galaxy of extremely well-known neuroscience names. Lord Adrian, of course, was one of your mentors.
Yes.
Sherrington is somewhere off in the corner. And ultimately, it gets to T.H. Huxley.
Yes.
J.Z. Young is somewhere in the firmament. Yes. And you had students that included Pettigrew.
Yes.
Who then?
Colin Blakemore.
Colin Blakemore. Pettigrew became a teacher for Ramachandran. So there's this amazing community.
Yes.
Of scholars, which I think is one of the things that Francis Bacon was talking about when he talked in the New Atlantis about Salomon's House, this whole notion of communities of scholars. Can you think of any other industry or any other business where there are all these connections of people who are...
Oh, banking, for example.
Banking?
And, well, I suppose, in the old days, well, just you can tell from people's names, you know, there must have been a father-son passing on the trade as well as the...
Right. Is there another business you might have ever gone into instead of science, if you'd thought about it?
Well, I remember my father at one point saying, explaining that his side of the family was connected with the cotton industry, and that they were always looking for family members who would take on the responsibility and so on and so forth. But this wouldn't be an easy job, that you'd have to start on the factory floor and so on and work your way up. And I think, without exception, we all turned down this offer. But other family members did go and did follow that, of course.
Yeah.
Not in my branch of the family, but in other relations.
You grew up in Cambridge?
My grandparents lived in Cambridge, my Darwin grandparents.
Right.
And so we visited here frequently. But I didn't come here and live here until, in Cambridge, until I came up as an undergraduate.
Okay. Apart from being this 200th anniversary the Darwin anniversary. Later in this year, of course, is the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin. But there's also an anniversary just about now, which is the 50th anniversary of C.P. Snow's Two Cultures lecture that he gave in Cambridge. And there's been quite a bit of press about that. Do you have any thoughts about this, the sciences and the arts? One of the reasons I asked, by the way, just to interpolate this, is that I also read in the current newspapers that there is a race on for the chair of poetry at Oxford.
Oh, yes.
And one of the leading contenders is Ruth Padell.
Oh, yes.
Who would be, by my reckoning, a niece of yours?
That's correct, yes.
So she's part of the whole Darwin
industry
as well, business descent. And in fact, her latest book of poems is a cycle of poems about Darwin, Darwin's life. So there's this admixture of arts and sciences, so I thought perhaps...
My two parents, one was definitely on the art side. My father read classics, but then became a civil servant. So but he's always very interested in origin of words and language and things like that. Whereas my mother was a scientist through and through, you know, and so I was always exposed to the opposition of these two views and the collaboration too. And I mean, a good scientist is as much an artist as he is what is the popular corresponds to the popular view of a scientist, who's dispassionate and objective and unconcerned with the emotional aspects of work he's doing. You know, that's not true of any good scientist I've ever known. That they're always passionately involved in the work and emotionally involved as well.
Who's the most outstanding scientist in your mind? Who do you recall as having been the smartest or the wisest? Those are not the same things, but
well, the person who has obviously had the biggest effect on state of science is Francis Crick. I mean, there's no doubt. But when I look back at the people I was taught by in Cambridge, I mean that's Adrian, the elder, so to speak, and also the younger, but there was Alan Hodgkin and Andrew Huxley, and a person who I worked quite closely with, William Rushton. I mean, they're all quite exceptional people. I suppose it would be possible to rank all of them in order of importance, but they were all so exceptional that I'm reluctant to do so. I mean, they excelled each other in different respects. I mean, the smartest of the lot is Andrew Huxley in many ways, who, having solved the problem of nervous conduction with Alan Hodgkin, then went on and made very major contributions in solving the problem of muscle contraction. And he was an absolute whiz on optics. And I remember putting a problem to him in optics. It was in one of those Christmas cards that comes round from the publishers of Perception.
Perception of the Journal.
Yeah, Perception of the Journal, yes. Yeah. And it beat me and it beat John Robson. And nobody else could explain it to me. But I showed it to Andrew, and he was very puzzled by it to begin with. He said, well, can I take it away? And the next day I got a single page of handwritten explanation saying exactly how it worked, you know. And he invented co-invented and developed the interference microscope, so he really very skilled in that area. And in designing mechanical devices, he had a microtome for use with electron microscope, which he developed.
The journal Perception, which you mentioned, which is one of the primary journals in your field, obviously, which started in 1972 by Richard Gregory.
That's correct, yes.
Who I think is still the editor-in-chief.
Yes.
And indeed has a paper with Stuart Anstis in almost the last, most recent journal, copy of the journal. Is there something about being British and... It seems to be that there was a huge interest in visual perception, and particularly illusions, visual illusions, which is now spread over here, of course. But
yes, the country, which is equally distinguished in vision and hearing, is Holland. They've always had a groups of people working on these problems, who've attained great distinction. And of course, there are lots here in the States.
This same issue of Discover magazine happens to also have in it a nice piece, an ad from the National Science Foundation saying the evolution of evolution, and telling you how you can read some more stuff about Darwin everywhere. But there's also on the following page a two-page spread here by the John Templeton Foundation.
Oh, yes.
And it's an advertisement, but it says it's celebrating the bicentenary of the birth of Charles Darwin, and it asks the question, does evolution explain human nature? And then there's a series of responses from various people, including the primatologist Franz de Waal, who says the monkey. There's a comment from Joan Roughgarden, who's professor of biology at Stanford, who says, not yet, and almost surely never. There is a comment from Lynn Margulis. There's several of these remarks. I mean, two things. Where do you stand on these kind of issues? And plainly the intersection of religion and science was an issue in Darwin's day. It appears to have been one of the reasons that he took so long to publish The Origin, the fact that his wife was so religious and so on, he didn't wish to harm her feelings, or indeed almost anybody else in those days. This issue is still with us. We've done meetings here, the Beyond Belief meetings and so on. Do you have a comment on these sorts of issues?
Well, of course, I mean, Dawkins is the most extreme example. And though I find myself agreeing with a lot, both of his factual and his emotional arguments, I mean, he's tinged, obviously, with very deep disrespect for religion. But it's clear that religion was not only responsible for transmission of knowledge on which science is based through the ages, but also for encouraging the development of new knowledge, and it's all the academic establishments in the older universities are strongly connected with religion. So it seems to be foolish to say that it's completely, even if you only believe in the merit nowadays of the scientific side of an argument, just for historical reasons, one's got to give some respect to the religious tradition. So I don't think one should be too rude to them, except when they're rude to us. You know? and I appreciate the fact that that Dawkins gives as good as he gets, and usually seems to come out on the winning side of the argument, my way of thinking, at any rate. But I just feel that it's, you don't win arguments by being rude, but by hopefully by the actual merit of the argument itself. So one should concentrate on that.
There have been some issues, obviously, as you know, you're a member of the Royal Society, fellow of the Royal Society. The Royal Society has had issues internally about whether it should accept grants from bodies which have religious connections and so on and so forth.
Well, if you can do without them, much better.
Let me go back to this notion of reductionism. Mm-hmm. And although to explain is not to explain away, mm-hmm. There is nevertheless a general feeling that we are being reduced to just material goods. That one hears from certain people. There's V.S. Ramachandran, in his book Phantoms in the Brain, Phantoms in the Mind, has a footnote at the back where he has a little story in which, let me just remind you of it. He says here, this misapplication of reductionism leads to the perverse and tenacious belief that somehow reductionism itself will tell us how the brain works, when what is really needed are attempts to bridge different levels of discourse. The Cambridge physiologist Horace Barlow recently pointed out at a scientific meeting that we have spent 5 decades studying the cerebral cortex in excruciating detail, but we still don't have the foggiest idea of how it works or what it does. He shocked the audience by suggesting that we're all like asexual Martians visiting Earth who spend 50 years examining the detailed cellular mechanisms and biochemistry of the testicles without knowing anything at all about sex.
I can't recall saying that, but I think it's very true. When he says that there are different levels, and there are different levels and we'll examine things scientifically. I mean, in vision, which is my own speciality, one of the levels of examining it is to look at the responses of human observers to carefully controlled physical stimuli, so-called psychophysical approach. And many of the most important things about vision were discovered using that technique. For example, the extreme sensitivity of the eye to light. People didn't realize that it got down to the quantum level until they started looking, until they started showing that human observers could detect very small packets of quanta entering our eyes, and when you did certain calculations showing how it was lost at all the different stages in the media and only a fraction of it was absorbed, it turned out that only perhaps a dozen or so quanta are absorbed. And that was proved purely by psychophysical methods. Well, of course, you want to supplement that, which has now been done, by recording from different elements in a pathway. So this is a case where the whole problem was stated by the was set on a map, so to speak, by the psychophysical approach. But you also you need to carry it out also with the reductionist approach and find out, well, how do these single cells respond, and so on. So even in a narrow field like that, there are many different levels. You can examine it scientifically, and that's what I think we should do. With the reductionist approach, when you can get down to the for example, in the case of light, you can examine the methods whereby a quantum of light absorbed in a single photoreceptor causes changes in that, and which eventually result in an impulse being transmitted back to the brain. But somehow, to me at any rate, those details, intricate details, are fascinating of photoreception itself. But they don't have any general implications, whereas the way that you can detect a single quantum does, because that leads you to the question of signal-noise ratios and statistical efficiency of the brain. It's been fashionable in many parts of psychology to decry this and say that we're hopelessly inefficient at doing statistical judgments. But that's not true. If you give the brain the right statistical judgments to make decisions about, it turns out to be highly efficient, which means that means in crude terms that if you were to take a record, exact record of what went into the eye and pass it to a statistician, or take two records and ask whether they belong to the same population or different populations, and bring the full force of your modern statistical methods to bear on this, and use an optimal procedure for deciding such questions, the human can do very nearly as well. Can't, of course, do better. That would be impossible. But it does seem to make use of almost all the evidence that it is available, provided you ask it the right question. So that we've got a very efficient statistical machine up here, not a crude bowl of porridge. And you reach this view by looking at the problem from the more global approach, not in the first place from the reductionist approach. So you need to all the levels you can, and then the evolutionary approach, which was you were mentioning, that's yet another level. Well, how did this amazing equipment between our ears evolve? And of course it did evolve. I mean, we have it, we know that, but we don't know. We can't follow the individual steps of how each particular mutation was favored or not favored. We're a long way away from being able to do that. But then how does belief in God help one to have the kind of equipment we do actually turn out to have? I mean, that's a valid question. And I don't know what the answer would be, but one of the answers must be that it's a means of ensuring the preservation and propagation of knowledge, that you build up literature, so to speak, and a verbal tradition, enhanced and so on with ceremonies and so on, which somehow establish a mode of behavior in the community, or tend to establish it, and that has beneficial evolutionary results. And though I'm neither an expert in understanding these things on a social level, but I think one can see that there's a lot of truth in the idea that religious beliefs in a community do serve a function of that sort, of making it more homogeneous and more mutual comprehension between people. I mean, this is why family businesses exist, for example, because of the shared family connection means an increase of trust amongst members, and so similarly, belonging to the same religious community has that effect, and you end up with a social community that, in which people can cooperate more effectively. So that there are so many things that we don't understand in any reductionist detail, and yet one can see that there is maybe an evolutionary advantage to them, that I think one has. Though I tend to be radical and unconservative in most details, I think there are good reasons to be somewhat conservative about throwing away all aspects of religious belief. And I don't know that we should necessarily get a better world by driving religion out.
This is on the same, roughly the same point. One of the things that I was going to ask you about was the the way in which science is perceived by the other members of the public who aren't scientists. And I was noticing in a couple of newspapers recently, yesterday, for example, a new study has shown that the melting of the ice caps or something will produce a rise in sea levels, which is only half of what the preceding report had said. So, I could cite dozens of examples like this, and it does seem to me that one of the things that a general public seems to like is certitude, so that it feels as though it's getting the goods on something, it can act appropriately in a certain situation. Whereas science, as we've just been saying, is not in the belief business, it's in the doubt business.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
And there seems to be this disconnect between the two. I don't know if you...
Well, people, students too, prefer certainty. If you give a lecture which expresses doubts about certain conclusions, your students will hate you because
they want to pass the exam.
They want to be given certain simple facts, you know, and they don't want to have be instilled with doubt about these things, which makes it much more difficult for them to write and to absorb new facts and so on. They've got a point. I mean, they've got to absorb a lot of knowledge, and they want to absorb the certain knowledge first. I mean, their bias in favor of certainty is justified. And perhaps one should not lecture to first-year students saying, instructing them to doubt every statement they hear, or encouraging them to doubt.
Well, that goes back to Huxley, of course, doesn't it?
Yes.
Stand before fact like a child.
Yes.
On that point, that was written as a response to the letter from Kingsley after Huxley's son had died. And Kingsley was inviting him to take refuge, if you like, or comfort from a religious perspective. And this is the famous letter in which Thomas Henry Huxley wrote back and made his theoretical stand about being an agnostic and how fact was important, so on and so forth.
I've never read that.
It's a wonderful letter. But that entire generation, we tend to forget that your great-great-grandfather, Charles Darwin, and Emma Wedgwood, his wife, how many children these Victorians had.
Yes.
These were enormous families.
Yes.
And there was routinely two or three children would die.
Yes, absolutely.
Randall Keynes's book about the effect on Darwin, Charles Darwin, of Annie's death, his daughter Annie, at the age of, what was it, 10 or something, was devastating.
Yes.
So these issues obviously were very much to the fore, even in as you have somebody there who's figuring out the mechanisms for how all this works.
Yeah.
It's always struck me as a remarkable to have been to be a member of that family must be somewhat interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's sometimes a bit intimidating too. Well, I mean, one of the things about Charles Darwin is that unlike many scientific and other heroes, he seems to have been a very amiable and straightforward gentleman, you know, and obviously much loved by all his children, but that's true of almost everybody, is loved by their children. But he's very much loved and admired by almost everybody who knew him, I think. And the way he dealt with the Wallace, for example, I mean, it's very easy to make that into a... it would have been very easy to make that into a story, you know, that... Wallace really discovered it and Darwin only sort of pinched his idea and gave it publicity, which of course is true. He didn't give it any publicity until Wallace came along. But then he actually handled it, if you know the details, rather sort of honorably and well, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult to make a real villain out of him, which is unusual.
Who would you have, is there anybody you would like to have had dinner with and had a conversation with historically or even now? Who is it?
Well, his grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was obviously a very fascinating person. And now sticking within the family, and Galton too. Mm-hmm. Those were, but I've had my fair share of conversations with quite a lot of distinguished people. So I don't know whether I would very much like to have known Mozart, for example, I don't think I've enjoyed Beethoven's company so much, but and other great artists, you know, would be interesting to have known, got to know them a bit more.
Yeah. Is music a major factor in your life, or?
Yeah, well, it's, I enjoy it very much. Yes, yes. Yes, I don't think many other people enjoy my music.
Oh, you play?
Sorry?
You play?
Yeah, I do play, yes, but not up to performance standard, shall we say.
Which instrument?
I played various instruments at various times. I tend to take one up, and as soon as I find out I can't play it very well, I give it up. You know, that doesn't work.
So, what would you say is the biggest mistake you've ever made, and what did you learn from it?
Well, I always regret very much that I wasn't a more meticulous observer, a meticulous recorder of what I was doing, because obviously Charles Darwin himself was, and many of my contemporaries keep meticulous notes and so on of what they're doing at any time and why they're doing it, and their speculations and so on. And that would have been a very good habit to have acquired. I wish I'd done. Somebody had drilled that into me when I was at university. But as far as actual errors, so to speak, there are quite a lot of my publications have things in them which I would now regard as wrong. And I recall one particular thing which I remember was when I was working on the frog's retina, and one of the sort of lessons from that was to suggest that a far, it's what the story of what the frog's eye tells the frog's brain, but this was actually done several years before that, and it was becoming clear that many of the things that we used to regard as going on in quite high centers of the brain were actually going on in the retina, like the center surround arrangement and so on. And one of these I came across was the fact I came across from behavioral studies was that the backward to forward motion in the visual field is much more effective in eliciting nystagmus than the forward to backward motion. So I thought, well, it'd be interesting to see if this bias exists in the retina. So I made some observations of this, and the results came out negative. I mean, it seemed that ones responding selectively to motion in one direction were as frequent as ones selective to motion in the opposite direction. So I never published anything on it. But of course the actual fact that in the retina there was directional selectivity, that the neurons responded better to motion in one direction than the other, was there staring me in the face, but I didn't see how important it was as an example of a kind of mechanism which is much more elaborate than anything that people had up to that point expected to be going on in the retina. And this dawned on me suddenly, actually, by a conversation with Kiefer Hartline by the side of his swimming pool. I went and worked with Kuffler in America in the 50s. And this is before the publication of Jerry Letwin's article. And he said, what do you think of these observations about things that happened in the frog's retina that Jerry had been talking, he must have talked to him or heard at a small meeting or something like that. And the example that Kiefer Hartline gave was, he says that some of the neurons respond to motion in one direction and not the other. And I suddenly realized that this is an observation that I had myself made and I knew to be true. I was so embarrassed, I don't think I brought it up to have missed the significance of the fact. I don't think I brought it up with Kiefer Hartline, actually. But that was a blunder, a mission of the first order, and an interesting one, because it shows how theory can mislead. I mean, I had a theory I was testing, and it put me completely off the track of making pertinent observations is your first job, you know. And I'd failed to record this observation, which was really quite important. Because of my eyes were diverted to another possibility.
That's very interesting.
So I've always been rather in favour of theories as opposed to, you've got to make guesses, and if you don't make guesses, you won't get anywhere. You know? But you've also got to record the unexpected things you find.
And be especially critical of your favourite hypothesis.
Yes.
Popper would say, attempt to falsify it, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
You have to go and prepare for your lecture now, but let me ask you one last question. What are you optimistic about?
Oh. Well, I'm usually optimistic about my own latest hypothesis, so to speak. I'm optimistic about that, but we don't have time to go into it here.
I'm
optimistic actually about the current state of America. You know, Obama seems to me a new phenomenon. You know, and well, let's hope it all goes well. I'm not so optimistic about the state of Britain. But I'm also optimistic about the state of science in America too. It seems to be, in the areas that I know about, in a flourishing state, you know, whereas it's neither so well supported in England, nor is neuroscience recruiting such good people and so on. So I'm a bit depressed about that.
But you think here there's
yes.
I think I mentioned to you that we're planning to do a meeting on this subject, using the old Bacon phrase about the merchants of light. So perhaps there's more light on the horizon here.
Yes, I think there is. Yes.
Right. Horace Barlow, nice to see you. Thank you very much.